they are still, as I said, pain is so much. If we try to explain to them why there is pain, they said, this is all philosophy, doesn't make any sense to me, please get the tooth out. If it is a tooth, it's okay, tooth can be taken out, but if it is your right arm, what do? You say, take out my right arm. If it is your leg, what do? Take out your life, right? Is that the right solution? The solution is to inquire and see where the pain comes from, what the pain is owing to, and see what is the remedy to it. Is intervention, what is called invasive surgery, the only way out? And there are other ways out. So far, spirituality has only succeeded through a kind of a surgery, invasive surgery, cutting you off from life. Nothing, no punarapi jananam, punarapi maranam. I don't want to come back to life, I don't want to have this experience, I want out. That has been the solution, and since the pain is so excruciating, any relief from this pain is most welcome. I don't question that at all. But all that I want to emphasize is Aurobindo's yoga depends on this primary problem, question, why are we here? So he says, remember why thou camest, find out thy soul, recover thy hid self. So for all solutions to problems of existence, the remedy is not 5-year plans, better parliaments, better social laws, better taxation. These are needed, but the real solution has to come from within. And therefore he says, find out thy soul, recover thy hid self. Right now, your self is your ego, and it is only natural when there are two egos, they have to clash. Even if it is the ego of the husband and the wife, the mother and the daughter, the father and the son, there are no egos which will remain in harmonious relationship for very long. That's the very nature of this ego. And so if there are so many crores of egos in this world, you can imagine how there is bound to be all the while chaos and conflict, etc. in this world. But if everybody begins by going back to one's soul, then one realizes every other person in the world is a manifestation of the same soul of which you are a manifestation. So what now irritates, difference irritates. Differences irritate us. But once you take your stand within, differences enrich you. There are different ways of being, manifesting the divine. So variety, they say, is the spice of life, right? So God has made this world so various, each person is so different. This should not be a cause for conflict and unhappiness. This should be a cause for giving you delight. That's the difference between American eating and Indian eating. Kentucky fried chicken is the same from Alabama to Texas. But you go for sambar rice in India. Chettinad sambar is different, Madras sambar is different, Madurai sambar is different, Bangalore sambar is different. Of course, for sambar haters, all sambars are equally bad. This is what life is all about, being able to take delight in this multifariousness of God's manifestation. And so, the yoga therefore has to begin by going within yourself, find out thy soul, recover the hid self. In silence, seek God's meaning in thy depths. So only when you go within yourself, then you will understand what it is one is supposed to manifest in this life. What am I supposed to do? I don't know. My father thought that it would be very lucrative for me to be an engineer, so I became an engineer. Or my father thought if I did medicine, I would be able to get to London and do medical practice, so I became a doctor. I was never asked. Somebody else decided what my fate is, and even if an opportunity is given to me, I won't go within and ask myself, what is it that I want to do in this life? Because the mind knows only one thing, do that which will give you more money, more fame, a very rich father-in-law. These are the values of the mind. And they work a while, but later on in your 40s and 45s there is a midlife crisis, you are doing very well, and yet from within there is a dissatisfaction. You wish you were doing something else, but it's too late to change. So the rest of your life you just spend worrying about why it is that you made that particular choice. So we don't know what it is we are supposed to do in this life. For that also you need to go and consult your inner being. What is it? You want me to be a bricklayer? Not because it's a fashion to be bricklayers or potters, but because the inner being says, this is what I want to do, and you do it. So even for happiness in worldly terms, happiness, fulfillment of all parts of the being, one has to consult one's deeper being and ask oneself, what is it that I should be doing? Therefore he says, find out thy soul, recover thy hid self, in silence seek God's meaning in thy depths. Then mortal nature change to the divine. Manifesting God through your life is an equally important aim of this yoga. One is to find your oneness with the divine consciousness. Finding your oneness with the divine consciousness is the first stage. But most people, because they have found their oneness with the divine, they run away with this finding. But in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, because you have found your oneness with the divine, you bring that power of the divine and change your mortal nature into the divine nature. As long as your nature is made up of sattva, rajas and tamas, which can never be in equilibrium, and therefore always the balance keeps changing. Morning you are very sattvic, feel well about the whole world, you want to help the world. Then maybe later at 10 o'clock the rajasic element comes up, then you are very angry, you want to conquer the world. In the evening tamasic element may come out. Our nature is like this, all the time keeps changing, and we have no control over it. And if this nature is changed, human nature is changed, then what now is a cause for worry, cause for keeping us always unsettled, becomes a powerful tool in our hands. So the mother has said there are two goals to our yoga. One is to find the divine. If you can't find the divine, if you don't find the divine, you haven't even started on your yoga. After finding the divine, use the power of the divine to change your nature, to manifest God through your nature. Manifest Him through your body, manifest Him through your vital, manifest Him through your mind. This is the second objective of yoga. So this is very clearly mentioned here. Finding the God, finding the secret of your life, the purpose of your life in here within, and then manifesting it through all the parts of your being. In these four lines, as I said, the aim of yoga is very clearly laid out. Open God's door, enter into His trance. Opens God's door and merge your consciousness into God's consciousness. Cast thought from thee, that nimble ape of light. If I pause to comment on each one of these lines, we won't go very far. And we have really need to go very far. We have Canto 3, Canto 4, Canto 5, Canto 6, Canto 7, etc. And this part we did in some detail, a great detail, some 2-3 years ago. So many of the stalwarts of that time are still in the audience, so probably you remember many of these things. The next few lines, all the other remaining lines, give you a concrete program of sadhana. First, he says, cast thought from thee, that nimble ape of light. Thought, mental questionings, mental doubts. What is the nature of doubt? The nature of doubt is to doubt. Sri Aurobindo said there is no... doubt can't do anything else. What is its nature? It's to doubt. So if you give it solid gold, it will doubt. Why does it doubt? Because its nature is to doubt. So very often doubt, questioning, they are very good. One has to doubt, one has to question, particularly in spiritual life. A sharp mind, human reason are very important, because this is a murky land. One has to step very cautiously. One has to have eyes all over one's body, look at every corner, otherwise one can be misled. So although the light of the mind is an unsure light, it still can be used and has to be used. So mind's light, therefore he says, cast thought from thee, that nimble ape of light. Don't let your search be controlled by your nature to doubt. You see, ultimately the function of reason is to organize what you have received through intuition. What you have perceived, if you have a good reason, if you have a good mind, you can present them logically, you can present them systematically, you can present it in a way the world can make sense of. Why was Sri Aurobindo trained in the West? Why was he not sent to colleges in India? The Divine planned it in such a way because he knew this was a man who was going to receive all new knowledge. And you need an instrument which will then be able to present all this knowledge in a way which appeals to human reason, human mind, not only in India but all over the world. So in which language therefore should he be trained? He should be trained in the world language. And which is the world language? Whether you like it or not, it is English. This is the language of Saraswati. Saraswati waited for us to accept Sanskrit. We have discarded it. And Saraswati have said, Indians themselves don't want Sanskrit. Let us take over English. So English is the language for which Sri Aurobindo was trained in England and for which he had received all that. He made very good use of it when this new knowledge came. He did not use the Western training to acquire that knowledge. This knowledge came to him as a result of yoga. And what came to him as a result of yoga, he was able to present in the way he has because his mind was very well equipped and trained. And therefore, this is what our mind should be able to do. Our mind should be always available to us as a good servant. It should not be your master. There are other parts of our consciousness which should lead the spiritual search, and the mind should follow. And the mind should explain, mind should organize the experience. In his tremendous hush, stilling thy brain, his vast truth wake within, and know and see. To be able to receive truth, to be able to perceive truth, you don't have to exhaust all the books in the Library of Congress. That is not necessary. What is needed is creating in the mind an absolute hush, an absolute silence. And in this silence of the mind, thoughts come pouring down. Sri Aurobindo is a very good example of it. In 7 years, he wrote 25 books. I don't think anywhere in the world you have an example of 7 years, 25 books have been written. And he said, when he stopped writing in 1920 for the Arya, he said, I had enough material, I could have gone on writing for another 70 years. but he stopped for various reasons that are not relevant to us now. So a kind of Niagara of knowledge entered into his waiting mind, because the mind had been hushed. Lele had taught him in Baroda the technique of silencing the mind. Silencing the mind is not deleting the mind, is not weakening the mind. Silencing the mind is a process by which you really begin to know where knowledge is and open yourself to that knowledge. Knowledge is all over this place. We don't know how to receive it. It is this knowledge, it is this inspiration which comes periodically to a great poet, a great artist, a great musician, a great thinker, because they have a capacity to be tuned to that wavelength and receive it. And because of their tremendous ego, they put their stamp on it. This is the human nature. Sri Aurobindo was never did that. He said, I have never written anything which my mind thought of. It has always been something that came from another level. And the same thing about Savitri. Why did he take so long? He said, people may not give me any credit for being a poetical genius, but I'm sure they will at least give me the credit for being able to wait for the right word. I waited for 35 years. Can you wait for 35 years for the right line, for the right word? That's what I did. So he had phenomenal patience, phenomenal capacity to wait for the right word to descend. So poetry descends, knowledge descends, philosophy descends, all these things are descents. That is how the Vedic Richas are written. They were not seen by anybody. That's why they are called apaurusheya. They don't seem to be knowledge acquired by the human mind. Of course, they were received by the human mind. They received by X's mind or Y's mind or Z's mind. But X or Y or Z were aware of the fact that they were not the owners of this knowledge. They were just recipients. They were just postmen who received this knowledge. And therefore, they were not very keen on putting their signature. Oh, I have written this. There was no I. It just came and they just, very often, everything in India, the India seems to have only one writer. What is the name of this writer? Vyasa. The whole Mahabharata was written by Vyasa, Bhagavat was written by Vyasa, all Puranas were written by Vyasa. How many things did he read? Didn't even a computer in those days. Not even a typewriter. How did he write? It is the whole country wrote. The genius of the country wrote. But never claimed it is my little bit. And they said, who is the author? Vyasa. Vyasa also means in Sanskrit the editor. So this is the editor. Who is the author? The divine is the author. I am simply the editor. That's what it shows. So all knowledge, this is the tradition, this is the old spiritual tradition. All knowledge comes from above and we just receive it, provided we are in a state of consciousness where you receive things. There is absolute silence, no perturbation of desire, emotion, no wanting, absolute silence, and you wait. And once you learn to wait, once you learn how to wait, all these things come. And that's what he says. What page was it? As I was speaking, I think this 476, okay. Yeah. In his tremendous hush stilling thy brain, his vast truth wake within and know and see. Cast from thee sense that veils from thy spirit's sight. This is the great teaching of the Gita, which is, as long as desire comes to us because of our attachment of the senses. As long as desires arise in you, they pervert your perception. Desires, we think, are a means of finding happiness in life. But the Gita thinks the other way. It says, desire is what limits you. desire is what curtails, narrows your capacity to take delight out of life. Desire is not what gives you delight. Desire is what makes you narrow. Desire is what makes you small. Desire is what warps your perception, falsifies your perception. So desire, give up desire doesn't mean you become moral. That's not Gita's teaching. Gita doesn't talk about morals. He simply talks about impurity in your perception of the world. Desire adds impurities to your perception of the world. You don't see what the world is. You see it only through the grid of your desire. That's why the persistent teaching in the Gita, slay then desire. Slay desire. Why? By slaying desire, you become whole, you become complete. All the perversions in your being are just washed off. That is why desire has to be given up. Not that God minds our watching a TV serial once in a while or eating what we want once in a while. It is not these. But being conditioned by these, conditioning your perception of the world by these, that is what limits us. And that is why he says, cast from thee sense that veils thy spirit sight in the enormous emptiness of thy mind, thou shalt see the Eternal's body in the world. Once you have silenced your mind, once you have purged your consciousness of all the limiting things called desire, then you will see a different world. This whole world that you now see, with so many warts on it, with so many things that irritate you, you all the time unuttered curses. When you walk the road, we find so many things. Walk the road, not Pondicherry road, walk the road of life. You find so many things unpleasant, unsavory, unwholesome, with which you don't agree. You don't like the way people salute God, you don't like the way this happens, that happens. We're all like that. Suddenly all these things changes. Everything begins to look to you different. Has the world changed? No. What has changed? Your perception has changed. Aldous Huxley has a little book called Doors of Perception and Gates of Hell, where he reports what happens when you take marijuana, one of these drugs. When you take these drugs, what happens? There are chemical results out of taking these drugs which make you see a different world altogether. But the only danger with that is, it can be a different world in the sense you see the world all as paradise, or next moment you see it all as hell. You don't know which is the real world. That's the problem. So our entire texture of our consciousness can change mechanically through chemical substances. But yoga changes your consciousness without injecting in you any chemical substances. The only thing it does is it purifies your being. All your desires are purged off, all your perceptions then change. Thou shalt see the Eternal's body in the world, know Him in every voice heard by thy soul. Then, every person that you see, your irritating neighbor, people, the chap in the bank who just ignores you when you walk in, all these suddenly look to you as God's messengers. And your way of reacting with them, everything changes. You recognize God in every contact with the world. That's what he's saying. Know Him in every voice heard by thy soul. In the world's contacts, meet His single touch. There is a Maharashtrian poet who has prayed to the Lord, O Lord, grant me this boon, that wherever I touch my head, I touch your feet. Wherever my eyes rest, I see your face. That's the divine pervading all the time. Now, anything but divine pervades us. Who is at fault? The way we look at it, the way we react to the world, that's at fault. We don't want to admit it. We all are busy cleansing the world. Better roads, turpentine, this, that, wash it. There is not enough water in Pondicherry to wash the roads. How will you wash them? that's a different matter altogether. But this is basically what spiritual life is about. There is an inner change that takes place in him. In the world's contacts meet his single touch, all things shall fold thee into his embrace. Once that happens, every experience for you is an embrace of God. Conquer thy heart's throbs, let thy heart beat in God. Let your heart, your desire be merged with God's desire, your will with God's will. So you have no separate throbbing of your heart, you have no separate impulse of your will, everything is merged with the divine. Thy nature shall be the engine of his works. You will then be a perfect instrument, a perfect agent for doing here God's works. This is a world in which God has made a great deal of investment. And God is very much interested in bringing this world to perfection. And he has chosen you and me to play our role in this great enterprise. Some people he has given great strength, great power, great intellectual power, great money power, great political power. Why has he given all this? So that we participate in this enterprise of bringing perfection to this world. So our primary job therefore is to be perfect instruments of the divine. But the instrument also has a responsibility to make sure that it's an efficient instrument. If you want to be an instrument, you have to be an efficient instrument. That is, you have to train your intellect, you have to discipline your heart, you have to be strong in body. What's the use of some weak instrument which God, which wants to be used but can't be used? So we owe to ourselves to be in a body which is strong, which can be used by God. To have a mind which is well disciplined, well trained, not for selfish purposes, so that we can be good instruments. So, even to be instruments of the divine, you can't just afford to neglect yourself. You have to perfect yourself and say to God, "Oh God, you have given me this. I have tried my best to make it as perfect an instrument as possible so that you can use it." Mere desire that God should use me is not enough. We also owe it to ourselves that we make this instrument as perfect as possible, as strong as possible, as pliable as possible. So yoga has two parts. One part is perfection of yourself, each part of your being. And then you become a powerful instrument which the Lord can use. Don't think Lord has used only namby-pamby instruments. You know, he uses this doesn't work. Then this doesn't work. We are all trying to be that kind of an instrument. Try to be a strong instrument. Whatever talents we are given to you, try to perfect them so God can use all these instruments. So that's what he's saying. Conquer thy heart's throbs, let thy heart beat it, God. Thy nature shall be the engine of his works. Thy voice shall house the mightiness of his word. Then shalt thou harbor my force and conquer death. I wanted to spend only 5 minutes, but it was irresistible. So I spent 15, 20, 25 minutes, but let us move on. So this is what is the complete agenda of yoga given to Savitri and also given to Ashwapati later. Ashwapati is also following this. But notice, in this agenda, nowhere are we asked, our daily program is not given. What time shall we get up? How many times shall we go to the samadhi? Should we wear saffron robes or white robes, western robes, eastern robes? Should we eat potato and onion and garlic or not? None of these is being described. Should you bathe yourself and go to the samadhi, or go to the samadhi and come back and bathe? That's not talked about. Should we read the Bible or the Gita or the Quran? That's not mentioned either. Because if you mention any of these things, which are very useful, bhajan, kirtan, shravan, reading, All these are useful. If they are useful to you, follow them. Don't ask others to follow your routine. There cannot be any yoga without any routine. One has to have a routine. But what suits your journey may not suit someone else. So if it suits you, follow it. Don't advertise it. Let each find his own way. And this is a wonderful world where each one of us is unique, and therefore each one of us has his own yoga. And I have no business commenting on his yoga or her yoga. They have no business in commenting on my yoga. So, let us follow Sri Aurobindo's example and be economical of speech, particularly with regard to other people's yoga. There are a number of things to discuss. What's going to happen tonight? India is winning or Pakistan is winning? There are a number of topics in this world. My favorite project in Pondicherry used to be how to find a new house. For 13 years I've been discussing it with people so that I don't have to discuss other people. It's nice to discuss about what kind of house you want. One story, two stories, this, that, the other. Quite innocent discussion. This is fine. I'm not saying, you know, you must be dumb in speak, but do not speak about other people's yoga. And the mother has said once, you're quite surprised, four austerities and four liberations. There she says, liberation, austerity of the tongue is very, very important. She said it is very easy to follow mauna. Don't speak at all. But she says, it is much more difficult to speak just enough what is needed for that purpose, no more, no less. That is very difficult. Mauna is easy because mauna gives you an egoistic satisfaction. When you go down the samadhi road, you know that person? He is following mauna. So, but if you don't follow any mauna, you don't do any of the extraordinary things, nobody points a finger at you. They just let you go. It's like, you know, it's like Sri Aurobindo says, it's more difficult to walk just 45 minutes each day. Each day, no matter what happens, 45 minutes you walk. Then, running 20 miles, 20 kilometers on a Sunday and taking all other days easy. Because if you do 20 kilometers, you talk about it during the rest of the 6 days to your friends and neighbors. You know what I did yesterday? I ran 20 kilometers. But if you walk only 45 minutes, nobody would regard it as a great achievement. What is it? 45 minutes? I always walk 1.5 hours. So that egoistic satisfaction is not there. So it is difficult to follow a routine, system, to stick to it, rather than do things which give your three-lettered word, you know, kind of exercise in expanding its chest, etc. So this is the yoga that Sri Aurobindo is talking about. This is why, see, in one sense, nobody has talked about the psychology of yoga in greater detail than Sri Aurobindo. Next thing that we see, mother herself or Savitri herself looks at her own being and recognizes various parts and planes of her being. It's very, very necessary because you have to know what you are made up of, how you are made up of. And complete knowledge of your own constitution is very necessary. This is a part of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Where is your vital? Where is your physical? It's not very easy. There is no scale which tells you, this is your vital. It doesn't come immediately like that, but this tendency to watch oneself, observe oneself, be aware of the movements within oneself, this has to be an ongoing process. And the mother says this is very, very important. And Sri Aurobindo and the mother have said a great deal about it. Our friend A.S. Dalal, as you know, has published a number of compilations which bring together writings of Sri Aurobindo and the mother on parts of our being, how to be aware of these parts of the being, etc. Don't expect to be an expert in this at the end of 1 week. This is an ongoing process. Consciousness, you become slowly and gradually aware of it. Now we are not even aware of what we are made. We are not even aware of our body. You know, if you have a pain in the back, you go to one of the doctors here. The doctor will ask you, where exactly is the pain? Oh, pain, I told you, it's in the back, but where in the back? Oh, I have only one back, so there's only four. But they will tell you, this part, that part, up, down, middle of the spine, left of the spine, right of the spine. I didn't realize it, all these complications. We don't know ourselves. Yoga is a process by which we gradually and slowly become aware of ourselves. That for that you don't need any discussion. Occasional dip into Sri Aurobindo's writings and the mother's writings clarify these issues for you. Then look within slowly, gradually, know yourself. And once you begin to know yourself, any problem comes up, like a doctor, you know exactly where the problem has come up from. And you can remedy that part. If you don't know, you just cry. Whether it's a toothache or whether it is something very organic, very fundamental that bothers you, you won't know. After all, a toothache, how much of your body is affected by the toothache? A small little couple of few cells here. Your body is all right, 99.99% is perfect, but only 0.01% is in pain. What do? You can't eat, you can't drink, you can't receive anybody. That's pain. But once you know the rest of your body is all right, nothing is going to hurt you a great deal, you can take remedy, you can take measures. So the first thing in yoga is to know oneself and see where the problem comes from, slowly quieten it, be in a receptive mood, and there is the great Lord to pour down His grace and His bounty in the measure in which you are ready to receive them. If God hasn't given you more, it's not simply because your acquisition order is faulty or He doesn't have these things in His store. He has decided that right now giving these things will harm you rather than benefit you. So please trust His judgment. Don't try to be supermental in 3 weeks. It will at least take 3 lives. That's early enough. So patience, trust in the divine, understanding oneself, it is all these processes that the mother and Sri Aurobindo have talked about. And no mechanical processes. Any process, I have said that again and again, in order not to be misunderstood, I will mention it once again. Even taking Ram Naam can take you to the highest realization. But this has happened to very few people. I have known people who have filled pages and pages of notebooks with Ram Naam. The only people they have helped is the paper industry. But if your consciousness is in the right poise, even Ram Naam or Gayatri Mantra, whatever, much depends on the poise of your consciousness, the intensity of the aspiration, and your capacity to reject what comes in the way of your fulfillment. All these things are important. So I am not against any ritual. If you say, I want to go follow this ritual, go ahead and follow it. But let it be your yoga. Don't press it on other people. That's why Sri Aurobindo and mother were extremely careful not to lay down any nostrum. This is what you should do. Morning this, afternoon this, evening this, then you can sleep. Find out what suits you. That's why there are no special bhajan sessions here. That is why ashram doesn't even encourage fools like me to give talks. Say, Sri Aurobindo has written all this, why do you need other talks? There is no propaganda department in the ashram. This is not now. In Sri Aurobindo's time and the mother's time, this has always been the case. They didn't want a propaganda department. Books are there, source of inspiration is here, you can benefit from it. And so, this yoga that you are given here may not look like yoga. It hasn't said how many times you have to repeat Vishnu Sahasranam, how many times you have to repeat Hanuman Chalisa. Not because they are not effective. Sri Aurobindo doesn't say they are not effective. What says is they can be effective provided your consciousness is in the right locus, poised in the right way. And so, since it's getting too late to go on into other things, I think I will stop here for today. And at the end of it all, if we don't make much progress, please don't blame me. Phase will be, as I read out to you, recognition of the various parts of our being. Savitri now goes into this introversion and recognizes the various parts of our being. Then comes the next stage of the yoga, that Savitri tries to go within, living within. Yoga is basically a process of living within and not living on the surface. So, how does she do that? How does she go?